And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Good evening, my little Jallo Pudding Pops. We're back in Italy this month for another Mario Bava masterpiece. Kill, baby, kill! Oh, look! It appears we have a message on the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror request line. Yeah, let's just take a listen.
Hello? Hello, is this the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror? This is Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm calling you because I have recently found out that you have finished your John Carpenter movie retrospective. And was wondering when you would be beginning the Arnold Schwarzenegger retrospective. I have very, very scary, very horrible films. Horrible films. I was even on an episode of Tales from the Crypt. Well, it was uncredited. I was the director. But that's beside the point. You need to do the Arnold retrospective. Jingle All the Way, that was horrible. Scary, ooh, very scary. Christmas is a scary time of year. I'm frightened with what's coming up. Because I have so many children to give presents to. Don't tell Maria, she won't like that. Anyway, I also have The Sixth Day. A good New Year's Day movie. Yes, about the end of the world. Yes, well, maybe we'll make it past the Mayan thing. I don't know, we'll have to wait and see what happens there. The Last Action Hero. Let's see. Christmas in Connecticut. That was a TV movie. All my Terminator movies. Kindergarten Cop. Twins. Oh, you know, I'm doing a sequel. Triplets. Yes. Wonderful. Of course, there's always my expendable movies, but we won't go into that. So, I would really appreciate that you start on the Arnold retrospective. Don't make me come down and see you. I'll be back.
Well, it appears Mr. Schwarzenegger's lawyers have not told him what a restraining order is. You guys go watch the movie. I have a phone call to make.
Ciao, amici, and welcome back to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror, Tales of Terror. As always, I am your co-host, Mr. Luke Giaconetti, and this month we're going to be continuing our look at Italian horror films. And as always, we've got a couple of fellow fear freaks here with us. First, I'd like to introduce my good friend from New York, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
Ah, what's the matter for you?
Ironically, I'm the Italian from New York.
Yeah.
To introduce my very good friend from New England, Mr. Hair Metal Hero.
Ciao.
And rounding out our group, last but certainly not least, my good friend from the great state of Oklahoma, Mr. Sean Engel.
Chef Boyardee, everyone.
Yeah.
And tonight we are going to be taking a look at 1966, Kill Baby Kill, continuing our programming on the work of the late great Mario Bava. And this is a bit of an interesting one for us because this is the first film in this Italian series we've watched that was in color.
Yeah.
I love Mario Bava in color, by the way.
Yes. It's beautiful.
Beautiful. Yeah. Lots of just splashes of blue and red and beautiful pastels. It reminds me of this old news film that we had to use in college when I was in film school because it was really cheap. And it was a reversal film, so you never had a negative. And it always came out with the same look. If you lit something, the colors would just come out so saturated and beautiful, much like this. And it was a feast for the eyes.
Yeah, it really was. And this, and after the kind of noirish take that we got, especially with the girl who knew too much, getting something in color and this kind of oversaturated look, I think this will prepare us a lot for things that are coming down the road. So I was very happy to see this. And just real quick, again, because this is an Italian film, there has to be a by contractual obligation about half a dozen other titles that this film is known as. it is native language. It is Operazione Paura, which translates to Operation Fear. Some of the other titles that it was known as is Curse of the Dead, Curse of the Living Dead, and my personal favorite, Don't Walk in the Park.
Ooh.
And Don't Walk in the Park.
was there really? Even a park in this?
There's a swing, yeah. But I don't think that constitutes an entire park.
This is going to be, actually, this is a film that was named this so that it could be paired on a double feature with Don't Go in the Basement.
Thank God it wasn't paired with, Barefoot in the Park, because that'd be really awkward.
Actually, not the only horror film to be renamed in such a way specifically to pair it with Don't Go in the Basement. There was a co-Italian-Spanish zombie film, actually a really good film called The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, also known as Let Sleeping Corpses Lie. And this one was known in the U.S. as Don't Open the Window, specifically to pair it again with Don't Look in the Window. And there's no window scenes in that movie.
What was the dead title for this? Not the Living Dead one, but the one before it.
Curse of the Dead.
What of the Dead?
Curse.
Curse of the Dead. That's the only title. That should have been the title. That's the only title that fits out of all of those titles. That's the only one that sort of makes sense.
Even the native Italian title doesn't really make sense.
It sounds like a war movie.
It does, doesn't it? You expect like Borg 9 to be in this.
Exactly.
Or just Borg 9, just little blonde, creepy bitches.
Baby Kill has that sort of Mondo, like, you picture like drugged out,
Big-titted women.
Like a Russ Meyer movie.
And Sid Haig.
Yeah.
Because I was talking to my wife about this earlier, and I said, yeah, we watched Kill Baby Kill. She goes, what's that about? I go, you wouldn't know from the title. it's like, again, I agree. Curse of the Dead is the only one that really makes sense when you look at this. And this is probably the last best of Bava's gothic films. Very similar to Black Sunday, this is a story that is a kind of traditional gothic horror that's kind of updated a little bit with modern filmmaking sense. But, this is the kind of story that very easily could have been done by Hammer or Amicus or any of those other studios that were operating around the same time in the West. It's just, here, because it's done, shot in Rome, we get Bava doing it, and so it's a somewhat more visually memorable than if, say, Terrence Fisher had done it or somebody like that.
Yeah, it's got that very Hammer. It's got a sort of Sleepy Hollow feel to it when he pulls up and the carriage man lets him out and says, I'm not going to go any further than this. It was getting a real, in front of the castle gates. It's very Dracula feel to it. But Italian all the way.
What I like also is, and this is something again that we'll see again, I love that it begins with a violent death.
Yes.
Yeah, and a very odd violent death. Not someone killing someone, but someone, throwing themselves from a high place onto a spiked, grate or a spiked fence. And then the camera lingers on the body throughout the entire, minute and a half, 2 minute credit sequence. It's a really stark image, and it really kind of sets the tone for the sort of creepiness vibe that's going on throughout the entire movie.
Yeah. And like you said, since there's nobody, pushing her or anything, it seems like a suicide, but from her body language and from her weird Italian actress acting, it seems like she's under some sort of duress, but it's just, it's not really clear exactly what's going on. And then to totally clinch the Italianness of it, once the opening music kicks in, it's that, you know, you can tell it's set in the past in this, you know, olden times setting, but then like the rock, semi-rock music, you know, mondo-y yeah. rock music with the snaky bass line going, you know, and it takes on a 60s feel automatically. It's, yeah, there's something about that chemical brew that just says Italian.
Mm-hmm.
Smells like a pizza in the oven.
Yeah, it's like somebody took a box of crepe pies and just blew them all over the screen.
Yeah.
Boom. Here's all this color in your face. Take it.
Yeah, interesting about the credits, this is the first time that we'll see as assistant director is Lamberto Bava, who is Mario Bava's son, who would go on to direct a couple of horror films himself, including Demons and Demons 2 and a couple others. And he is, you know, his background, again, like his dad, was in cinematography. So one of the many proteges to Mario Bava who would become known feature horror directors in their own right. That is always interesting. He popped up here. This is the first, I think this is actually Lamberto Bava's first credit. He obviously wouldn't achieve the success of his dad, but that's kind of, you know, big shoes and all that.
But not bad for...
No, I mean, obviously, I mean, he's doing better than me. I haven't directed an Italian horror film yet, so what can I say?
Hey, stick with the Monza Corp, baby. You never know. Someday.
Yeah.
Someday he might get a $500 budget and a crew and a script and off you go, and a deadline.
Jeez.
Talk about a low budget, and like all the films that Bava got to work with, I know that in the, you know, the 50s and 60s in Italian cinema, there wasn't a whole lot of money being thrown, a lot of lira going around, you know, and it's part of. And we've seen this, you know, we see this when we talked about John Carpenter, is that, you know, the sign of especially a genre director and a horror genre specifically is if you can make something just really scary without needing a lot of money,
right?
You know, then you're really tapping into it. And so far of the series that we've watched, this is by far the freakiest one of them all.
And it's, you know, it's really only a few sets, few outside exterior shots that were probably all in the same village, you know, they were all probably in the same location, and but there was inside interior of a few houses and you know, the mortuary and
pretty much
there was an interior slash exterior set for the graveyard and stuff like that. But yeah, and not really a lot of special effects outside of some blood, you know?
Yep.
Lights and smoke and weird, creepy music. And, well, one thing that always, if you're not going to have special effects, evil children. Always turn up the creep factor.
Oh, yeah, Melissa, the creepy girl in this, good gravy. I mean, you want to talk about something that does influence so much to come after it. I mean, would Japanese horror as we know exist today if not for this friggin' creepy ass little girl in this movie?
I think she. Exactly. I think like a little King Diamond went to the movies with his parents and peed his pants over this, and that's why we got the song Melissa.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I mean, go ahead, John.
I was gonna say that. This is, you're exactly right. This is probably why we've got so much of these Japanese horror movies with these little kids just freaking us all out. This is stereotypical, this stuff. And we've seen, it's kind of interesting to see with these Bava films that we've covered, we've seen sort of initially with the first one, a very sort of James Whale type universal horror film vibe. Then with the second one, we got a sort of Hitchcockian film noir vibe. And with this one, we've got the stereotypical haunted house type thing going on with the strange ghost girl and all that. So it's really interesting to see the progression of Bava and how influential he's been to horror films, and how he's taken influences from previous horror type films and done his own adaptations of them.
Yeah, Yeah. I mean, Bava was, he was a student of film and of cinema, and his you know, the things that he enjoyed and the things that he appreciated, they're plainly on display, you know. And this one also gets back a little bit again to Black Sunday, where Bava was a big fan of legend and of, you know, the supernatural myth and things like that. And so this takes place in Carpathia, you know. So again, you, Hero, I think you mentioned it has kind of a Dracula mm-hmm. vibe, or Chris mentioned.
Me. Yeah, but...
And that's, I mean, that's clearly on purpose, you know. It's clearly the, you know, the doctor showing up in the village filled with the superstitious, you know, ignorant commoner kind of thing.
Who may not be as ignorant as it seems, really.
Science, we'll get to the bottom of this. Yeah. It's like, that goes for you, pal. But yeah, but you know, but Jesus Christ, Melissa, in this movie, the first time, the first real scare, when we get her hand on the window of the inn, as I know it's coming, and it freaks you out, and it's just, whoa, yeah. Okay, turn the lights.
Because then they one up the hand with just her face glaring, and you're like, why yeah. did I see that? I'm not gonna sleep now.
Well, like you said, he's using just the simple elements of horror. He has like the, for one, the window's all fogged up, and you know, an old like semi-opaque window, and there's fog outside, so you see the hand coming through the fog. Plus, it's like all distorted and faded from the window. It's really super creepy. Plus, it's like, I'm sure they gave her like a nice layer of talcum powder to make yeah. it all extra white and from the grave.
And then you get the hit on the soundtrack as soon as there's contact with her hand
mm-hmm.
on the bang, and it's that, you know, just an extra bit of jarring right in the back of your head, and it's like, oh, of course the ultimate one to me is still when they're in Kier's house, and Kier goes upstairs, Kier the burgomaster, and he opens the closet, and she's in the fucking closet, and it's
yeah.
like, ah, yeah.
She's just sitting there staring through you with those, in that creepy little white gown, and those eyes, oh, they're looking into my soul. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
Your soul or her eyes?
Both.
Oh, just, I mean, you talk about a spring-loaded cat scare that delivers. It's like cheese and rice. That is, oh. And
it's not even spring-loaded, though. It's just, here it is.
Yeah.
You don't even need to do anything to make you jump.
Yeah. And that, you know, oh, God. And it's like, and this film is 1966. That holds up. It's 2013. That holds up. Mm-hmm. It's still scary. You show mm-hmm. that to, you know, any Joe Blogs off the street, horror fan, not horror fan, you know, knows who Mario Bava is, or thinks Mario Bava is the guy who washes the dishes at the pizzeria. You show that scene, they're gonna be scared, you know. And that's yeah. always, I've said, any of these classic horror directors, even going back to Whale and the, you know, that era, the true classic cinematic era, is that if you make something that is scary, it doesn't matter if you have the best effects. It doesn't matter how gory it is. It doesn't matter, you know, if you've got a CG monster or not. Something that's scary will be scary because it's speaking to us on a certain emotional response level. And Melissa, the creepy-ass dead girl ghost, speaks to us at that, you know,
yeah.
that base fear level
yeah,
right there.
Yeah, this isn't like, it's not that any of the character or that any of the lead characters are people that you don't like. It's just that you don't really, they're not really people that you care too much about either. It's just that there's this relentless creeping dread in it. Yeah. And it's, and what I think differentiates like Italian and Japanese horror from like Western horror a lot of times is like in Western horror, everybody that dies will either have it coming and there'll be a concrete reason for it. Whereas in this one, basically, it's just that the little girl's malevolent and will look for any reason to wipe out townspeople. She just does not like the town. You're tough luck that you were born there. When your time comes up, Melissa comes for you, and it's pretty much over, you know. And that's what I really, really liked about this is the supernatural was basically a character in it. It's always in Mario Bava movies, you know, in in Western movies, we see the sort of effect of the supernatural. We see something that the poltergeist is throwing at you and stuff. Here, he just, and he doesn't make it blatant, but just in the way, and he did this in the last two movies, especially the first one,
Sunday.
Black Mask.
Yeah.
Black Sunday.
Where in this one you have the fog being sort of the spirit of Melissa moving around, and you're just sort of following the fog, you know, from one place to another till it gets to the bell. And at the in the beginning, there's a lot of just panning shots of the place that just sort of show you the place and just sort of give you the feeling that, yeah, if you were there, you'd have a cold chill running down your spine. You'd be like, I want to get out of this room right now.
Yeah. And go ahead, Chris.
It's funny because, like, a lot of the Italian movies are looked at as kind of trashy and cheesy, but it's very artistic. It's more artistic than, you know, our horror movies.
Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting about Kill Baby Kill, and this is a kind of a 180 from Girl Who Knew Too Much, is you mentioned that there's this kind of unending feeling of dread and creepiness. There's not a single moment of relief in this film.
No.
It's not a single moment that has anything other than the main storyline of, you know, Ursui and Monica and trying to figure out what's going on in the town. And so there's never a feeling where we're relaxed as the audience.
There's never a chuckle. There's never a comedy character or a character who at least, you know, yeah, breaks the tension with a funny line or by having a pratfall or something. Nothing.
And you know, you talk again about the village and how you get the kind of uneasy feeling. And Sean, you mentioned earlier that this kind of like the haunted house, old dark house type of motif. And, you know, Villa Grops, the, you know, where the Countess Grops is, you know, Melissa's mom. That house is so messed up. And there's so many weird elements to it. You know, Chris, you talked about the lighting.
Mm-hmm.
The really harsh greens and yellows that we get all throughout Villa Grops. It's just when you look at it, it's like, no, there's no way this place could actually look like
no.
this. There's no way lit like
they'd
this.
They'd have to have, you'd be stumbling over the lights as you walked it, because like there's all these lights coming from the floor and at weird angles. You'd be tripping over them every 2 feet.
Yeah. Well, and the entire house is amplified by the effect that they do in some of the later scenes where the main hero character is running through the house and he keeps lapping himself, and eventually he catches up to I guess an alternate self and confronts him, and it's just it adds on the creepy factor of the whole thing.
Yeah, I love that, the repeating room where Ursula, he runs through the room, opens the door, and he's in the room. And
yes.
And Bava runs it for about three times, and then you say, then he pulls back and you see him, he's running out the far door, he's coming in. It's like, okay, that's just weird.
Exactly.
and he's
running through there trying to find Melissa, but
Monica.
Yeah, Monica, yeah. And it's just, it's unnerving. You know something's wrong with it, and it could be pulled off initially as a sort of goofy Scooby-Doo thing with people running through the doors and coming out other things. But when it happens just over and over again, and then he's almost catching himself, you know, as he's running through, then it starts to get creepy.
Yeah.
Really good aesthetic there.
Yeah, and they do it again with Monica when she's going, she doesn't catch herself, but when she's trying to run down the spiral staircase.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's tapping into something. You know, when people say a nightmare they always have is that they're falling. Well, another very common nightmare that you hear people describe is that they're running and they can't get to the door.
Mm-hmm.
That's you know, again, that's something that's a very kind of visceral fear. She's running down those steps, and she's running down the steps, and the steps keep getting longer.
Mm-hmm. And that's an intelligent, you know, and using the spiral staircase and looking down from the top is a great way to do that, because you get not only the sense that it's still, that it's never ending, but you, when Bob is able to spiral around the top, it gets that sort of vertigo feeling.
Exactly.
Plus the way it's lit, with the sort of I saw oranges and blues. Yeah. It gives the look of this sort of
kaleidoscope,
you know, shaded eye.
Oh yeah,
you know, it's
yeah.
The,
and vertigo is a perfect word.
Yeah, no, that's also another creepy bit.
Go ahead.
All the camera work is amazing in this. It's like that shot where you're watching it, where the camera keeps racking focus in and out. You know, the first time you watch it, you go, "What the hell is that?" And your mind catches up, and you go, "That's somebody filming from a swing set." But they're keeping they're not filming from a swing set, but it's like they're on a swing set. And
yeah.
Your brain catches up with what it's supposed to be, and you go, "How the hell are they doing that?"
And then you hear the creepy laughter of the kid. Oh, that permeates the entire film. Whenever you hear that, it just chills.
That must have been super. I mean, because when this first came out and that wasn't a trope at that time, it must have been so insanely creepy. You know, so much more than it is today.
It's weird watching it.
And that speaks to it. That's cliche now. The creepy girl with the creepy laugh like that. But it's like I said, it's a trope, but in this film it still works. You know, you can even if it becomes a trope, if you do it good, you do it good. You know,
there's a reason
if you're the first one doing it. If you're the first one doing it, it's not a trope. You're an innovator, and we're seeing here in general, Mario Bava is an innovator. Even when he's taking stuff, you know, like Hitchcock and Whale before him, he's doing it in his own way and being innovative about it.
Well, it's like you said before, it gave you the feeling of vertigo, but it was literally like shots in the movie Vertigo with that spiral staircase. You know, it was very much the weird optically printed rack zoomed shots from Vertigo, but in a totally, you know, different context and feel and place. He's very unlike what's his name, Brian De Palma, you know, who sort of was like, "Hey, look, I'm doing Hitchcock."
Yeah,
he's just sort of he's picked up ideas from, you know, I just think of him more now that I watch his movies as an artist rather than an imitator. And when I was younger and I'd see the Italian movies, I'd be like, they're just imitating American movies. And sometimes it would really work, like with the spaghetti westerns. But I always looked at it as imitative. And now I look at it as these guys, they had a limited budget. They were trying to make money, but they really wanted to make art. They really wanted to put that extra effort in it that makes them stand out as a director rather than just, you know, having a successful exploitation movie. They wanted it to be a Mario Bava movie. You know, he wanted to build his own vocabulary and touch on stuff in the subconscious and add all those little extra bells and whistles that a good director like Hitchcock does. Yeah. And you can tell he probably learned a lot of it from Hitchcock. So of course it shows up there.
And you know, and no matter where you are, East or West, the best directors and the best filmmakers, whether you're a cinematographer, a screenwriter, even an actor, what you do is additive.
Mm-hmm.
You build on things that have come before, the things that have influenced you and that, again, that you're interested in or things that you were attracted to, but you add something to it. If you're truly at the top of your craft, you take what's there and you build upon it. And then the next guy who gets the ball, he builds upon that. And that's, you know, that's, we talk a lot about parallel development, how two things in, you know, two properties that are from, you know, unrelated, whether from people working on it and geographically and all that, can develop along certain lines. It's because everybody's part of the same, has the same type of contemporaries, and they're all tapping into the same type of zeitgeist of that moment. And in the 60s, you know, there was a lot of the what we call the neo-Gothic movies, you know, and this is one of them. And this was additive to what Fisher was doing with Hammer, what Amicus was doing. But even some guys in the States were doing. There were, you know, there were American Gothic films, a lot of things coming out from AIP with Vincent Price in this era, that Corman. This, you know, and again, all these, what do these guys have in common? Like you said, they are working with a small budget. You know, you have to be creative. You can, if you want to make a good product, you're not just a hack trying to make, you know, give me 75 minutes to put on the screen. if you're actually there and you've got real talent, these are why these guys' names keep coming up. That's why we keep talking about, you know, I mean, this is almost, 50 years ago. We still talk about Mario Bava. We still talk about Roger Corman. We still talk about Terrence Fisher. It's because, like you said, these guys had a desire to make the best thing they could with what they have. You know, the joke from Mystery Science Theater 3000 is the Roger Corman lighting method. Light and get away. But, you know, it works. And it's the same thing here. It's, you know, it's Bava's.
I've never heard that before. I'm sorry.
Just light and get away. But it, you know, it, but it's true. It's all of these guys use, you know, there's an economy of time. There's an economy of film. There's not extraneous scenes put in generally. This stuff is designed to be just a tightly made film because these guys had the skill to do it. And that's why they kept getting called back by producers. It's like, well, you can make a good movie and you're going to stay on budget. And you're going to get it done quick because you're a professional and you know what you're doing.
Oh yeah, no shit. When every story thread is tied up in this movie, the end flashes on the screen. There's not even a scene for the two leads to catch their breath. It's just like the end. It's like, oh yeah, okay.
And everything happens in this film in the span of one day.
Uh-huh.
Shows up in the morning, and the next morning is the end. And what that also means is that since it's only taking place in one day, you don't need to costume people for multiple days. They wear the same clothes the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
That's a... yeah. Good to check that.
Saves for continuity, too.
Yeah, don't got to worry about it. But yeah, it's, I mean, this, and the thing about Kill Baby Kill is that for a long time, and you still can't find public domain prints of it, that they're really not good-looking prints. But I think a lot of the effectiveness of the film still shines through, even on those public domain prints. I have the DVD that's in the Mario Bava box set that Anchor Bay put out, the first one. And I think the Shriek Show have a DVD out of this. I don't remember.
I'm not certain. I watched it on Netflix, and I'm pretty certain it said that it was pulled from the Mario Bava collection, because that's how they... put it out as the opening credits to it. So,
and that's the version on YouTube is that one too.
Yeah, it looked really good. You know, it was in widescreen. The color saturation was really nice. It didn't look, you know, like a horribly grainy VHS copy.
Right. And so, I mean, if push comes to shove, you can watch it a public domain cut. But man, this is one, especially since it's on Netflix, to track down it and watch as it was shot, just because you'll be missing so much watching this pan and scan with the color muted out. And it's visually, you'd be missing out on so much. I mean, you'd still get the story, and the story is fairly straightforward. There's not a lot of twists and turns here, but the overall effectiveness, I think, is dampened if you don't have the full frame to see some of the camera tricks that like Hero was talking about on the swing, or the colors that we talked about at Villa Graps, the pure saturated, almost theatrical style saturated color, you know. So if you don't have, I mean, that definitely, if you're gonna watch this, you know, steal somebody's Netflix password. I put that in air quotes. I don't mean literally steal somebody's password. We do not authorize that at Demonza Corp.
Yeah, definitely don't take somebody's sign-in information and then watch all the Mary-Kate and Ashley videos to profile them as a child molester.
I wasn't... Those kept showing up as my... Addicts. Jesus.
I won't tell you what Chris watches when he borrows my password.
Thank you. What's funny is... It still says hello to Chris, no matter which one of us.
We have that special.
you gotta be careful who you give your Netflix password to. When I first got Netflix, it was a number of years ago. It was like 2003. One of the first films I put on there was the John Frankenheimer film Grand Prix, which is one of just as far. I'm a race fan, so I just love that movie just from the visuals, you know, and. I wanted to watch it ever since I got my big screen TV. And my wife has kept putting it back further down on the list. for several years. We got here a couple of weeks ago, and it's like, yeah, that's right, it's Grand Prix time, baby. 8 years in the making.
See, you should be glad that you don't have little girls, because aside from my, you know, recently viewed list of, you know, Kill Baby Kill and Bay of Blood, is My Little Pony and Tinkerbell and the Magic Fairies. So it's my kids like Netflix as well.
But that exactly, that's the kind of thing that sets off red flag for profilers and stuff.
Yeah, well, perhaps having an email address with the name Joe Anthrax in it, it probably isn't the best thing.
Ah,
either.
That's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I see it. It's like the district. This is a slam dunk. This guy's a nut job. Yeah. Look at him.
They're probably picturing some like 20-year-old like anarchist guy.
Yeah.
If they only knew Family Man with two kids, you know, upstairs podcasting with his friends
in the Midwest. Yeah.
It's quiet guys. It's always those quiet middle America type.
Well, we did
he
have Tim McVeigh.
So normal.
That is, you know, I've often, people used to ask me that when I was in like, you know, as I was entering high school. I went to a Catholic school, you know, big shock. And they say, oh, well, I did have a teacher tell me that I'd be dead before I was 25. And I wanted to call her up and say, sucks to be you. But, you know, it's to say, you know, what your life goals. And I want people to talk about me on TV. He was like, well, he was a quiet, never bothered anyone.
If you were a true psycho, you would have showed up at that teacher's house just before midnight of your 25th birthday. Like, hi, Mrs. Tyler, or whatever her name is. I don't know why I'm picking Tyler, because I'm looking at Chris Tyler's name on my Skype.
You show up to my parents' house, my mother will probably invite you in for some tea or, you know, whatever. I don't know, whatever it is.
Yep.
I don't know.
Travel, probably.
Like, I'm a circus hero, but apparently all moms sound that way to me. So.
I'd pull a Hannibal Lecter and, like, go over there and have dinner and, like, not tell Hero about it, and she'd be like, a friend of yours was over the other day. Very nice young man.
I'm having an old friend for dinner.
We're getting married.
Oh,
I think my father might have something to say
about
that.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And yeah. And suddenly it starts to get weird.
Suddenly.
And then it got weird.
Yeah. That happens in this film, you know. It seems like it's going one way, and then shit gets weird. Like the daughter at the innkeeper's daughter, when she sees Melissa, and then she's all freaked out because she's gonna die. So they call Ruth. They call the witch, and Ruth's cure is apparently to flagellate her with the reeds.
Yeah.
Reeds, yeah. And it's like, okay. That's just a little odd, isn't it?
Well, as soon as you hear the line, take off her blouse. I'm like, all right, Italian movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then not only does, you know, the flagellation happen, but then they decide to wrap her chest with like this weird barbed wire chain thing. Ah,
it's almost like a crown of thorns for your boobs or something. Yeah, it was weird. It was some like penance thing. It was strange. Yeah,
the Catholic Church is weird like that.
And the Catholic Church is weird like that. I can speak from experience. And then, you know, then what does Ursula do? He takes it off, and then she dies. She impales herself on the, I don't know if it was like a spinning wheel or what that was, but she just drives herself in. It was like, yow!
It was just like the sharpest, most impractical candle holder ever. Didn't it have like the candle at the end of it?
I think you're right.
Yeah,
and it was basically right at neck level. It was like it was just the most bad idea to have around the house.
Yeah, there's poorly thought out decoration choices all through this. We see Melissa's room at the Villa Grapps with all the dolls, and it's like that kind of room. If a girl takes you back to her place and that's her room, it's like, y'all turn and say, watch out, you'd be talking to yourself, because that's how fast I'm going to be out of there, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, of course, again, because, you know, we're not already freaked out enough from having her sitting in Kier's closet, then she's sitting with the dolls, and that's just even fucking weirder.
Yeah, she's just there. Hi. Yeah.
Hey, what's up?
With the dolls.
Oh, yeah, that, you know. That's what I'm saying. This is when you watch this, you got to watch something else just before, you know, kind of cleanse your mental palate a little bit before you try and go into a dark room or something like that.
She's a great little evil kid ghost because she loves it. She toys with them. She laughs. She's enjoying her job. She's bringing joy to it. She messes around with. She leaves her dolls at the end of their bed just to tenderize them before she moves in for the kill.
And Monica's nightmare itself is really kind of trippy as well. When right before she wakes up to find the doll at the foot of the bed. Doll heads and the swirling colors. It's like, oh yeah, this is. I've had nightmares like this. Usually there's sake involved. But... That's a story I'm not allowed to talk about.
And that was the second time I got crabs.
Then we had some bad shellfish, and it all went downhill from there.
I love the Burgermeister Daddy Warbucks guy, too. He totally looks like Yul Brynner.
Does he? He looks like Yul Brynner, like the Bollywood knockoff of Yul Brynner. It's like if they made a Bollywood version of The King and I, it'd be this guy in it, you know?
I'm just so glad that we have someone that's a Burgermeister that isn't in, you know, a Rankin Bass cartoon. That's awesome to me.
Yeah. I also thought for sure he was going to be evil. He's bald. He looks a little evil. He's married to the witch. He's the Burgermeister. He should have something to hide. So I was like, go ahead.
I say he's kind of the wormy guy.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it turns out he's not so bad of a guy. So, of course, he ends up dead.
Yeah. But that's the sort of final impetus for Rita, the witch, to go in and take out the Countess Grops.
Yeah. Yeah, she does. She's like, it all, like, don't be messing with my man, bitch. You know, that kind of.
Yep.
Oh.
One of the weird things that we didn't really touch upon, the reason why the main protagonist, the doctor, was coming to this was to find he found that the murder victims, or the supposed murder victims, all had this coin stuffed in their heart.
Yeah.
And eventually that, I guess, was to ward off the, you know, was that to, like, ward off the souls from being attacked by Melissa, or what was that all
they
about?
They came back if they...
They would come back
and cause mischief if you didn't put a coin in their heart.
So
they didn't want... Yeah, so they were putting coins in their heart because they didn't want any more ghouls running around than they really needed, than necessary, I guess.
I don't know.
I guess in my last will and testament, I'm going to have to specify that, like, put a Snickers in my mouth so I don't come back as a hungry ghost. Will that work? Keep me at bay?
I want
no, they need to fill your mouth like Slimer in the Ghostbusters movie with just like hot dogs.
Oh yeah,
just a picture hero lying in state with the hot dogs.
Like 18 hot dogs stuffed in his mouth and like
and his will was like, he was so young, what?
He was so young. He was just starting to get in shape.
Shape an eggplant, but a shape nonetheless. Go. Oh. In my will, I want to dictate that at my funeral, the funeral march will be Candlemass's version of it. So you can get the, you know, the doom metal.
I've actually always said I want my entrance into the church to be when the saints go marching in, and then the exit to be a highway to hell. But I don't think that'll play.
See, at my wedding, I tried to get the final countdown by Europe played.
Oh god!
That got hit with the shutdown corner. I'm like, come on!
Well, you know what? You should have played at your wedding. Turn off the lights. The party's over.
Nice.
Oh, the lights.
Turn off the lights. The party's over.
See, women just don't appreciate this stuff. That's what it boils down to, you know?
I appreciate women. I appreciate them so much, I have nothing to do with them.
Nah, I'm saying.
It's mighty kind of
you.
We've gone in a weird tangent here, boy.
How did we end up here?
I don't know. I didn't want to bring up the fact that I think the little girl is played by a little boy, because that's really creepy.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know who plays.
I've read conflicting reports.
Oh.
So.
Fair enough.
If that's the case,
I didn't pick
that.
Then
it's a whole other level of weirdness.
Stranger, if Melissa is actually, like, you know, Carl or something. But
it's
hey,
Mel.
Hey, Carl.
Mel.
Mel. Mel. Yeah.
It's not a real scary name.
Yeah, we'll just put a blonde wig on her and call her Melissa. That's fine. He's a guy at school.
Then you start getting into other Italian movies, and then did that one.
No.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, geez, what else? What else can we say about Kill Baby Kill? This is one I really, and it's hard to do this in an audio medium to give you know, shout out to Andrew Leyland. But this is such a visually striking film that you really need to watch it.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna crack the whip on listeners to go out there and please watch. If you don't watch any of the other ones we're talking about, watch this one.
Well here's the thing. It's easy. It's on. Yeah. It's you can watch it streaming on Netflix. You can watch it on YouTube, and it's got the full. You don't even have to go from part to part. They get the full movie up there. It's pretty much the same quality as the Netflix version of it. It's like the same cut, and yeah, so you have no excuse unless you don't have a computer. Then how are you listening to us in the first place?
Yeah,
you so Amish bastards.
Yeah, how many? I wonder how many Amish people are listening right now.
Only the ones that are on Rumspringer.
Well, I have a message for any Amish listeners: get back to work. That's all I've got to say.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, everyone do yourselves a favor. If you're a fan of horror movies, if you're a fan of scary, you know, creepy movies with creepy little possibly boy girls in it, check this movie out. If you like The Grudge or The Ring or any of those haunted house type movies, check this out, because it's a treat for the eyes and it's a treat for the scary parts as well.
Yeah. 85 minutes of Technicolor gothic fun.
Yeah, and it can show you how to have a sort of nonsensical story and it won't even matter, you know.
Yep.
If you got the dread and you got the beautiful visuals, that about covers it all. Splash a little blood around and you're successful.
No, it's a universal language of horror right there.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, speaking of kind of the universal language of horror, that does provide an interesting segue to the film we're going to be talking about next time. Because next time we're going to be covering the last of the Mario Bava cycle of films from the Italian series that we're going to be watching. We're going to be watching 1971's Twitch of the Death Nerve. In this, be by the title A Bay of Blood. Those are the two most common names that you can find this film, or this film actually may have more titles than any other film in history.
Yes.
That is a shoot right there. So, but if you go, and I know if you go to Netflix under A Bay of Blood, you can see it there. That's the title to look for on Netflix. But Twitch of the Death Nerve, A Bay of Blood, various other titles, all the same movie. But again, when I talk about you know, just something that fits that universal language of horror, that this one will be it.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. I you know, guys, I've really been enjoying doing these, and I think we're really starting to hit our stride, because starting with Twitch of the Death Nerve, and I will always call it Twitch of the Death Nerve, one, because that's the name on the DVD I have, and also I love any movie that sounds like the album title from a death metal band.
Yeah. Or the name of a death metal band.
Yeah. Well, if you put them together, it's like the new release from A Bay of Blood, Twitch of the Death Nerve. But we're really hitting our stride, I think, into what, when you talk to, you know, horror fans in general, what they think of as an Italian film. We're getting into the very modernist sort of side of Italian horror. You know, we've covered kind of the background with some gothic and some noir, but now we're really starting to get into... like I said, the modern sort of film. So this ought to be a lot of fun next time.
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right, well, until we think of something clever to come up with to end going to say, thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show, and we will catch you on the flip side.
Yeah, get out of here.
Cannoli.
Yeah, cannolis.
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Anytime you plan to visit Amazon.com, please be aware that if you use the Amazon.com link located on our website, www.twotruefreaks.libsyn.com, Two True Freaks will receive a referral bonus for any items you purchase. There is absolutely no additional cost to you whatsoever for doing this. All proceeds go directly toward keeping new episodes of all your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated podcasts rolling, and it really helps us out. So please, use our Amazon.com link anytime you plan to visit Amazon.com.
Welcome to Amazon. I love you.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass. And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled Scott Gardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
And this is your Uncle Don saying good night. Good night, little kids. Good night. We're off? Good. Well, that ought to hold the little bastards.